Chapter 16, Close Calls, Coincidences, and Celebrity. This is sort of a miscellaneous bunch. Kind of wrap things up here. First off, in the close calls, there's, five or six times that I can remember came pretty close to being killed. So I thought I'd just kind of line them up here and run them off. The first one, of course, when I was run over by the Coke truck, which I don't remember. The next time I remember is on that trip to Mexico. We stopped the last night at a hotel in Texas. I was 5 and a half at the time, and they had a really nice big swimming pool. So we're all out there swimming, and I find that there's a railing at the deep end, leading towards the deep end, that goes down under the water. So I go hand over hand down that railing for a while until I decide it's not a good idea, panic, yell help while underwater, you know, that's blah, 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 and pushed up towards the surface where somebody found me floating up there and pulled me out, and this lifeguard had pumped the water out of me. The next time was when setting chokers up in Montana. When we got about 4 or 5 logs on there, depending on the size, we take them down to the landing. Well, those are really narrow, just bulldozed out so-called roads up there. And you knew enough to be on the upside of the mountain when they went around the corner, when that cat pulled those logs around the corner, because the logs would just roll down the hill. They were just on those cables until the road straightened out a little, and then they'd pull them back up off the hill. Well, one time I was walking on the downside of it, looked up and saw the logs coming. And I bit the dust. I got a mouthful of leaves and dirt, and I heard those logs flying over my head, any one of which would have decapitated me. So that sobered me up a little bit. One other time Jerry had a really good high school friend named John Castle. John's brother George was my friend. We all meshed in the same class a couple years apart. John had some sort of mental difficulty or emotional difficulty. Anyway, it maybe began when he was driving a load of kids back from a debate or something in Fargo, and they're going back to Jamestown, and there was a wreck, and he was driving. I think he just drove it off the road and rolled it, and one of the kids died. John was an oddball. He sort of adopted Jerry, I guess, or had Jerry adopt him. I know he showed up at Yale University one time, unannounced, and hung around Jerry's dorm room for a month or more. You know, kind of an odd thing. Anyway, he popped up in our place for one Christmas in... Well, I was at Carleton, I believe, and said he, after Christmas, he was going to drive back down to near Des Moines. Well, as it happened, I was trying to figure out a way to get to Davenport to meet my girlfriend's parents for the first time, Dr. and Mrs. Henry Stevens. He was a biochemist with the U.S. government in D.C. So John said he'd take me as far as Des Moines, which sounded good to me. So the night before we were going to leave, John wasn't there. He came over the next morning. There was a brouhaha at the Butler house, and in which almost everybody got in a big argument. Finally, Dad asked us boys, Dan and I, to go to the bedroom back there. And as we went, starting to go to the bedroom, I just put my hand on Dan's shoulder. I guess he thought I was going to shove him down the stairs or something. He turned around and sucker punched me right in the teeth, so he split my lip. So here I had this big fat lip, and I'm going to go meet my girlfriend's parents for the first time. Anyway, I get in this car with John, and we're not too bad off going through Minnesota, but when you get down to Iowa, the roads are narrower. I guess the carts were narrower, the old farm carts or something, were maybe narrower in Iowa to begin with, so the roads weren't, I think most roads are supposed to be about two lanes would be about 16 feet wide. Well, in Iowa, they're, I think, 14 feet wide. Anyway, and it's icy, snowy, and it's this is riding with John was a real experience. He liked to steer with his left arm or hand, and put his right arm around the back of the passenger seat, and look you dead in the eye while he's talking to you. So this led to a few problems. One of which was we're coming around upon a big curve. And you can just see at the other end of this curve is coming a snowplow. And John spotted it, I guess, at the last instant. Slammed on the brakes, which is the last thing you can do on icy roads. And we did the old dipsy doodle, spinning around. Spun around and spun off backwards into a farm road. Just as the snowplow was going by, and the plowman looked down at us and just shook his head. Well, we escaped from that with our skins, and then we go further on down the highway several miles, and there's, I swear, the world's largest left turn sign hanging off a telephone pole or a tree down there. It was just enormous. It showed that this highway had an absolute 90-degree turn, and we're barreling along there, and finally I said, John, there's a turn. Oh, he says. Slams on the brakes again. We go slide off the road into the ditch. We go bumping down the ditch till we hit another farm road that leads into the highway. Bounced up on that farm road and we're pointed straight where we want to go. He just drives off, gets us back on the highway. That was a real trip. Any one of those things in there could have killed us. At the University of Arizona, University of Minnesota. I borrowed my roommate's car one night to take my date home to her sorority, and on the way back home, this is a really bad night. A lot of snow, a lot of ice. A four-lane street was down to two lanes, and I'm driving along. I see a pair of red lights in front of me. I thought they're moving. They weren't moving, and too late, I slammed on the brakes. I turned the wheel and slid in sideways into the back bumper there, and turned out there was most of the people were outside of the back car measuring bumpers with a car in front of them they were planning on pushing. And as a consequence, I think a guy broke a leg and I believe a girl lost some teeth. I ended up on the floor of the car I was driving, did a bloody mess, and was taken to the University of Minnesota Hospital, where it turned out my whole problem was a bloody nose, really. So that whole thing led to a big old lawsuit because the car that I had borrowed had technically been sold to a dealership that day by my roommate's parents, and that all ended up in court as whose insurance is going to pay for this whole thing. Probably the one I... It remains the strongest in my mind is Mom and Hal and I went down, took the train down to Mazatlan one year. And when they checked in, they were going to take a nap, but I just changed to a swimming trunks, went down on the beach. And they had a sign up there that says No Salvador, which is no lifesaver or lifeguard. And there wasn't anybody else on the beach, and I just wandered off in this water a little bit and what they call the Sea of Cortez, we call the Gulf of California. And next thing I know, I figure I'm gone far enough, and I turn around to swim back to the beach, and I can't get there. It's I caught in a riptide, and honest to God, I thought I was a goner because I was working so hard against that riptide to get back to the shore, and the shore dropped off pretty quickly right there. And it just gave it an extra, burst of energy, last chance, stab at it. And my big toe on my right foot hit some sand, and that spurred me on, and finally got myself up out of that and onto the beach. And I just lay there like a beach whale, panting must have been for a half an hour trying to get my breath back. That one was really close. There's to change the subject to various other things here. Talk about coincidences in life. my folks, when we got over to Bemidji and they had the radio station, I think about somewhere along that year in the summer, they entered me into a talent contest because I'd picked up whistling while I was in the hospital. And they had this gal come in and practice on the piano at the studio there to accompany me when we got on stage. So eventually, you get on stage. I'm in a Palm Beach suit, and I'm still walking with a cane. And I get through all of this competition. I came in second place. It might have been because Dad was one of the judges. He slipped me a $10 or $20 bill on the way out of there and told me he was proud of me. That was good. Years later in Phoenix, I stopped at a watering hole. I think it was called the Palomino Pony around 32nd Street in Indian School. And it had a real nice piano bar. So I'd sit at this piano bar, and every few songs, this pianist would play the Minnesota Rouser, which is, Minnesota, hats off to thee, to your colors true, we will always be firm and strong, united are we, rah, 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 for sky, you rah, 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 for the U of M. So, of course, I'd bolt upright and sing along with her. And after a bit, she took a break, and I said to her, you know, you must be from Minnesota. She says, yeah. I said, well, I am too. She said, where are you from? I said, Bemidji. She says, me too. I took another look at her, and I said, Dot Palmer. She says, yeah, it's me, and I told her who I was, and we had a good laugh on that one. About in 1967, I was just married to Rosa the first time. She worked for Dr. Ginn at Doctor's Hospital, and she arranged with him to give me a physical. So I went and took this physical, and at the end of it, the doctor said, I don't think a physical is complete without a dental examination. So he handed me a business card, and I went over to this at this address, and it was what I call a dental palace, the first dental palace I've ever seen. Most dentists and were mom and pop affairs above the banks when I was growing up as a kid, and this one was a real dental palace. So I went in. I knew I couldn't afford this place, but they handed me in the front desk handed me a questionnaire, a medical questionnaire, so I filled it out as best I could. And in the end, I was called into the inner sanctum to meet the top dentist. And he read over the front of the medical page and then flipped it over and he bust out laughing. He said, when you had polio, they put you in the pest house in Fargo? And I said, that's what everybody called it. I know it was Saint something or other, I guess, but it was just a small... really small wooden building used as an emergency hospital for epidemics. He says, where were you, where was your bed in relationship to the ward you're in? I says, I was over near the long wall on opposite the entryway. He said, was there a kid in a crib in there? And I says, yeah, he was almost straight across me at the other wall. He says, somebody, teenager, blew up balloons for him and stuck them under his bottom. He bounced up and down until he broke the balloons, and that was about the total amount of entertainment in there. I said, yeah, that's right. He says, well, I was the guy, the kid that blew up the balloons. His name was Dr. Omer Reed. I think his father was with Boy Scouts or Red Cross, some organization like that. He was a honcho with them and the upper Midwest, and was in Fargo at the time. I shook hands with two heavyweight champions. The first one was Jack Dempsey, you know, Manasseh Mahler, in Bemidji of all places. He showed up there with somebody on a land deal promotion or a subdivision sort of thing. And anyway, he was down at the Lakeside Park down there, and I was introduced to him. I was surprised by the high pitch of his voice because he's something like, it's real nice to meet you. He must have been hit in the throat too many times. back in the, let's say, early 80s, We would fly up to Las Vegas for a company annual meeting, and Olivia, what the heck was her last name? Anyway, Olivia Lopez, but I forget her married name. She and I and our spouses, we left, I think, about 8 o'clock at night and got in at 9. And then there was an announcement on the air over the loudspeaker that our luggage had been held up. So we sat in a bar for an hour, and then finally they told us we could get our luggage. And there was a lot of construction going on at the airport at the time. Remember, it was kind of a temporary tunnel out of there. And we're walking up this tunnel, and in front of us is two very well-dressed, large black ladies with a black guy in between them. And he stopped for a second to turn. He did, to one of the ladies, and you could see it was Muhammad Ali. So Robert, Olivia's husband, yelled out, "Hey, Muhammad Ali!" And nothing happened. He turned around and with the ladies and kept on walking up there, still about, I'd say 20, 30 feet in front of us. And I yelled, "Hey, Muhammad, you are the greatest." See, and they stopped dead in his tracks, turned around, walked back down. He shook hands with us, and when he shook hands with the ladies, he just shook their, he took their fingers, but it was a very, very gentle handshake. Said how nice it was to meet us all, and it was very pleasant, you know. And that was a surprise. Way back in the earlier days here, had a couple things happen. One was we during the war years, mom and dad rented in a real rustic cabin at a lake called Jewett, north of about 10 miles north of Fergus Falls in Minnesota, and this was a purely very rustic. This had no running water, no electricity, an outhouse. A pump, you had a hand pump, you had to pump the water up in the kitchen, or as often mom wouldn't bother with us, she'd give us a pail and we'd run down to a spring and fill it down there in the spring. Anyway, for some reason now that escapes me, I was left there with Elmer Gore, Grandpa Elmer, and just the two of us for a week. And during that week, early on in that week, I was running through the water near the shore. I had a pair of tennis shoes on, but I came down and stepped on a nail that was run through a board, and it ran into the bottom of my foot. Well, within a couple of days, it was in pretty bad shape. And Elmer said, "We're going to have to take care of that." We had no telephone, no people near us, no way in or out of that place. We were just all by ourselves. So he told me to get, there was this bed with this, I remember this brass headboard, or brass railing type thing, and he told me to lie down on that and grab the railing, and then he got out his penknife and sharpened it up on a whetstone and then held it over a kerosene lamp. You know, it put off a lot of heat, those kerosene lamp chimneys. So he sterilized it that way. Then he grabbed the bottom of my foot and cored that infection out of there, like coring an apple. You might say it smarted a little. That was surgery without anesthesia. And I made that old, I remember I made that brass headboard sing. You know, it was really, really rattling. And I think I was probably rattling a lot too. Man, that smarted. Anyway, another thing that really smarted was when I was taken to the hospital to see if what was wrong with me during the polio epidemic, and they took me down into an operating room and to get spinal taps. I don't know if you folks have ever had spinal taps, but if you can avoid them, it's a smart idea. I had three of them, very painful. I'm lying on my side, curled up to get my exposure, I guess, to expose the vertebrae in my back. And the doctor said, okay, one more. And he took that one more, and I kind of relaxed because, well, we're done. And then the SOB hit me with a fifth one, and I think that one really smarted. I hated that guy forever. Another related polio thing was about a week after I got out of the pest house, Mom got a call from the doctors over at St. Luke's and said they had a girl there who was dying of polio. And, you know, in those days we didn't have, all we had was the Sister Kenny method of treatment, which was mostly hot packs and you know, some muscle rubs and stuff like that. So they didn't have a clue about the cause or the cure of it. But the reason that, because I got out of there with a fairly mild case of polio, that maybe I had something in my blood that would help this girl. Anyway, they asked Mom if I would come down for a direct transfusion, and Mom said it was my decision. I said, yeah, okay. So he took me down there, and there's two beds maybe 2-3 feet apart, and they just ran a direct transfusion from me to this poor unconscious little girl. I think she was probably about 8 years old, and I was around 12, I guess. Anyway, I heard the next day or two that she died anyway, so it was all in vain. But it was a sad thing, you know. You know, with the Korean War went on, I kept getting deferments until finally they all ran out sometime. It was right around the time I transferred to the University of Minnesota, and I got a notice to show up for a pre-induction physical at the Armory in downtown Minneapolis. And I went down there, and there must have been about 200 of us. They called a few out right away. There was had them sitting over on a bench. These were odd-looking people, you know. So not exactly sure what all their problems were, but they weren't going to be fit for military service. But out of those of us that were physically still walking, wandering around, performing for them, it got down to me and another kid. This kid had a bad knee, and they gave him a temporary reprieve. And I got this doctor, and he made me do all these different things, knee bends and stuff like that, he's trying to prove that I could work in the military. And finally, he had this sheaf, I guess it's my file there. He scribbled something on my file and threw it across the armory floor to a guard that's standing over there. So I walked over towards the guard. He picked it up, the thing, and big red thing on there, written on there, has CDNR. So I asked the guard, what does that mean? It says, candidate disqualified, no recall. He says, go home, kid, and forget it. Then when I'm walking out, I walked out with the other guy that had a bum knee, and the other kid says, I said, how'd you do? He says, they told me to go home and get it fixed. I got to come back in 90 days. So I was the only guy out of that 200 that didn't have to come back and serve in the Army, presumably in Korea. I think back one of the early influences on my life, a couple of them, of course, we talk about all those trips we took. I've been a bit of a rolling stone all my life, I think, since then. I remember one time I told Jerry, I counted him up, and this was a long time ago, that he'd lived in one place at the same time I'd lived in 27 different places. You know, kind of a bit of a wanderer, a vagabond. Some of that might have been from the trips, and also from the guests that Dad used to get over. You know, Dad would invite people over for Sunday dinner in Grand Forks, especially. I remember one was a Japanese sketch artist who made a pencil sketch of me. That was right before war broke out, so we were still speaking to the Japs. And then, you know, those guys on motorcycles that drive in big barrels out of fairs and circuses and such? Well, we had one of those guys home for a Sunday dinner one time. And my personal favorite was a ventriloquist Dad Dad persuaded her to come on over. And after dinner, we're sitting there in the living room, and a voice in the basement kept saying, "Help, help, help, help me." Well, we boys, we'd tear down the basement, look around all the way, tear back up in the basement. We couldn't find him, you know. He finally confessed that he was a ventriloquist. And I think probably the one that my folks enjoyed the most were, I believe, four young officers from, they were somehow assigned to the University of North Dakota. And at that time, during the war, Dad spent some time teaching out there as well as at the high school. And he invited these guys home, I think, for probably it was a Thanksgiving dinner. And one of them, real Southern kid guy, when we got all through, he says, "You know," he says, "how much we talk about Southern hospitality," he says, "but," he says, "honestly, it cannot beat the hospitality we had here today." And that was really a nice compliment. And I think I'm going to wrap this up just by talking a little bit about my family. I think we were blessed to have the parents we had, despite the, we all got warts, but despite the warts, they were really wonderful people. And I was especially blessed by the three brothers that I had. You couldn't ask for three better men. They, no two alike, all different, all had their tremendous personalities, I thought, and really, really good people. And they, Brother Jerry helped me out so much by taking me in when I got there from D.C., and that had me in there for that year. And I also used them a few times for legal services, you know, and nothing very serious. Mostly it was real estate stuff. The last time was for my last divorce. And the son of a gun wouldn't take any money. In fact, I think he even paid some of the expenses out of his own pocket. I once sent him a check for $500 to cover some expenses during the divorce, and he held on to it for about a month and sent it back. The only way I could get even on that case is I bought him some airline gift tickets, and managed to sneak them in on him into a thank you card, and he was stuck with them because they're in his name. But he was really flustered. He didn't expect that. And Dan and I had a lot of good times together. I wish he'd been around, because he and I really were chums at times in there on those trips in Mexico and places like that. He really missed him. And of course, Brother Bruce, it's hard to say enough about him for all he and Marilyn had done for us. And the great times we've had on the golf courses and places like that. I love them all. I love all you guys, all my nephews and nieces and cousins. And I hope that this serves a purpose somehow. I couldn't tell the absolute truth on everything. You got to hold some things back. And you can't get too intimate on your life. But I think what I've had is a pretty interesting life. And now I'm just living in the boondocks in Minnesota, having a laid-back existence. God bless you all, and I love you all. Thanks.